Hi, and welcome to this episode of Security Nation, the podcast where we talk to interesting people doing really cool things to advance security. I'm your host, Jen Ellis. I'm Rapid7's VP of Community and Public Affairs. And with me is my amazing co-host, Todd of the Beardsley. Todd!
Hello. Hi, yes, I am of Clan Beardsley, and I am here securing nations with you.
And you invited one of your very finest clansmen who has one of the very best beards that I have seen in some time.
Indeed.
Yes. The man, the legend, the beard, Nick Pococo. Hooray! Hello, Nick. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I'm really excited to have you on. So we haven't been around much lately, so sorry about that for all three of you who are burning for episodes of Security Nation. Hi, Mum. But we are coming back strong with Nick Pococo, who is the CSO of Kraken, which is a digital assets exchange. But he is also the man behind ThoughtCon, which is a super cool conference in Chicago that I've never been invited to. Boo-hoo. But Todd loves. Todd, tell me about your love for ThoughtCon.
I do love ThoughtCon. I think it was, what was it, 5 or 6 years ago, Nick asked me and Metasploit collaborator Egypt to come talk at ThoughtCon at a keynote, actually. So that scored me a black badge, which I'm very happy about, and which means I never pay Nick ever again.
So just to be clear on that, guys, I haven't even been invited to attend, and Todd got invited to keynote. I just wanted to make sure that everyone picked
right.
that up.
Yes.
No subtlety here. No nuance.
But instead of paying for a badge every year, I just pay what I would pay in a badge to the ThoughtCon charity arm, which we'll, I'm sure, get into.
Aren't you good?
That
sounds lovely. That sounds really good. Aww.
That was virtue signaling from yours truly.
Yeah, it was. Also, though, you set Nick up brilliantly. So, Nick, hey, tell us about ThoughtCon. Why did you decide, hey, you know what Chicago really needs? It needs a security conference.
Yeah, so I think this goes back to 2009 is when I had the idea for ThoughtCon. So it's quite a bit of time back there. It was over a decade ago. I was actually coming back from DEF CON, and after being in Vegas for, I don't know, 10 days, 11 days, very, very worn out on the plane, and started thinking...
You wanted to kill everybody you knew? Is that?
Yeah, so I was sort of sitting in my seat, probably in like 27 B or something like that on a United flight back from Vegas, and was just thinking like, hey, I've spoke at DEF CON, I spoke at lots of conferences all over the world, but I've never really spoke in Chicago at a conference, which is where I'm from and where I grew up, and there really wasn't anything substantial or anything sort of interesting going on in Chicago. So I essentially just was doodling on a napkin and came up with the, first it was going to be called 312 CON, which for anybody who's from Chicago would obviously recognize that, but 312 was the only area code in Chicago for a number of years until, the suburbs happened and cell phones happened and things like that. But, and so I was like, well, let's call it 312 CON. And then it just sort of evolved into ThoughtCon because it's TH for three and then O for one and then T for two is where the thought part of ThoughtCon comes from. So yeah, so it just sort of happened. I had no idea on how to start a conference. Literally no idea. And I just started that journey with inviting a bunch of my friends to a bar, basically, for the first ThoughtCon.
And how all the best things start.
Yeah, it was just I contacted a bar in Chicago and said, hey, I want to have this conference. And I'm like, I don't have any money to spend, but we can pay for beer and we can pay for pizza and wings. And so they essentially gave us the venue for free with a food and beverage minimum. And I charged some money for admission that paid for like the swag pack that you get. And it's very similar. ThoughtCon One swag pack is very similar to what you get still today. It was just sort of this thing. I was like, everybody gets a t-shirt, everybody gets stickers, everybody gets paper and pen. And so, that's where it all started. It started, 120 something people in a bar, basically.
Wow. That's a big bar.
Yeah. It was a place called Joe's on Weed Street in Chicago, which is a country bar, which after the first ThoughtCon was also having a cage fighting match that was going on. And so we had to be out of there by like 6 p.m. or something. We had to cut it off at 6 p.m. or 7 p.m. And literally as soon as I said goodbye, maybe we'll see you next year at ThoughtCon 2, people came streaming in with like these like chain link fences and we're assembling a cage in the middle of the conference floor. Yeah.
I'm sad that there isn't a ThoughtCon cage match now.
we could have one.
Oh my god, I might finally get invited. Yes.
That's right. Jan Ellis, MMA. Master.
This is my moment. All right, so you started out by going hanging out in a bar. And by the way, a nod to the t-shirts. Like, I frequently see people wearing ThoughtCon shirts at other conferences. They are always very high caliber shirts. Mm-hmm. Always a lot of compliments from a lot of people.
Awesome.
So kudos on all of that. I think that ThoughtCon has definitely developed its own voice and brand in a pretty impressive way, and has a sort of a culture that feels like very sort of hacker OG, but without being too bro-y or too far over the crazy line.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I think I don't necessarily know if like ThoughtCon 1 and 2 we're not too far over the crazy line. There's some interesting stories from back then, but we have matured, I would say, in the last decade, and now it's a very safe and friendly place for anybody to come and either speak or attend.
So, I mean, tell us more about that. Like, what was the process for maturing and what kind of drove it? You know, we've seen some other conferences kind of come up and move aside, and some that have evolved over time and some that really haven't, some that have devolved. So what was the process for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was, in some sense, a little more mindful. We had run into some issues early on. I mean, ThoughtCon early on was very much sort of like my idea of, I want to have some fun. I want to invite a bunch of people. I want it to be non-commercial. I want it to be not, you know, not on the record. People can say whatever they want on stage, right? Like, that was sort of the incarnation of ThoughtCon. But the nature of us having it at a bar in the first couple of years lended itself to some very bad situations with some speakers and attendees and people, you know, overindulging in alcohol because the bar was 10 feet from the stage. And I would say that in itself, that changed a little bit when we moved to the next venue after that, but we still kept some of that culture there, which was okay. And we still have it today. So there's still a bar in the venue and people still have a beer here and there, but it's not it has definitely evolved away from, hey, let's stand in the back of the room while a speaker's speaking and do shots and start yelling really loud and not pay attention to the speaker, right? That was early ThoughtCon, which it was a real big problem for me to try to solve. And we've moved past that. And we now have places where people can go and have their hallway con conversations in real hallways and not interrupt talks and things like that.
For somebody to come at it who has never organized an event before and has a full-time job doing other stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, how long's ThoughtCon been going?
It's our 11th year this year.
Amazing, congratulations. So when you started it, presumably you were at Spider Labs?
Yeah, I was the senior vice president of Spider Labs at the time. Yeah, so I had a full-time job, had like 140 people around the world working for me. Yeah.
So then, like, presumably, it wasn't all plain sailing, right? Like, it wasn't all smooth sailing. There were some bumps along the way.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think, so the biggest, I guess, a couple of things that come up when you're trying to start a con or trying to take something like this on yourself is, one, underestimating how long it's going to take for certain things. And two, finding, if you need people to help you, finding reliable people to help you is sometimes difficult, right? We all have day jobs, we all have families, we all have things going on, and someone says, hey, do you want to help me with this part of a hacker conference? It sounds really awesome, and it sounds like real interesting, and then sometimes life happens. And so, having people sign up for things and then not being able to deliver is okay in a volunteer world, but it's, at that level, but it's not okay for the sort of the show must go on kind of mentality when you're putting on a hacker conference. So I learned early on that if I was going to have ThoughtCon succeed, one, I needed to find reliable people, but then two, in certain areas of the organization and just doing things, I had to take it on myself and I had to do it in the most efficient way. And so, finding vendors for things, just sort of streamlining a lot of what I did over the years has really, really helped out, right? Like, now it's like, I have a spreadsheet with a bunch of tasks in it that essentially with dates in it of when I have to do something. And some of the stuff, there might be 10 or 15 items, like order swag for ThoughtCon, you know, 0xb. I actually have a bunch of tasks in there. I have vendors already lined up that I've worked with, and literally all I do is send them new logos and they know me and things just go into motion. But early on, that wasn't the case. I was running around like crazy, you know, stumbling, having vendors not. We do electronic badges every year. And until I found the team, you know, Jay and Rudy, who teach at DePaul here locally in Chicago, until I found them and the team and the students that helped build the badges, it was super stressful. I had one year when we did an Atari badge. So like every year I come up with the idea for the badge and I draw it up and I have all the components and everything. And then I find people to make them. And I did an Atari cartridge badge, which literally was a vintage Atari cartridge with our logo on it, stickers, everything, and played a real Atari game that we developed. If you plugged into Atari, it was a pretty ambitious project to pull off with in like about 2.5 months, including creating 1,000 of those, right? I think it was like 900, 1,000 of those. I found a really great guy to help me out online. I'd never met him before. And he basically outsourced part of some of the stuff that I was hiring him for to some students. And they forgot to ship like 2 boxes of badges. And so like, I got all these badges 4 days before the conference, counting them all. And I'm like, well, we're short, like 250 badges. What do I do? And the guy was like on vacation. And it was just real stressful. And finally he got a hold of some kid who was working in his garage for him, who was putting stickers on badges. And essentially, you know, was like, oh yeah, we forgot to put these two boxes out for UPS. And so I think they arrived the morning of the conference.
Nice. Not at all stressful. I cannot believe that you developed a game for your badge. That's kind of amazing.
There is a certain level of crazy when it comes to badge design. Like, I am not a big part of like hashtag badge life until now. Like, I'm trying to help out on a badge project for yet another conference. And yeah, it's bonkers. It's bonkers crazy.
Yeah, it's difficult. And like, you know, just trying to get it, because you got to imagine like a badge in itself. So like, there's one thing of putting on a conference. The badge in itself, like for me, is essentially like bringing a electronic product to market in a span of just a couple of months and hoping that the production run you're doing is going to work. we have had years where, like, you know, there's a failure rate and we make enough badges and some of them don't turn on, right? Because, you know, things weren't soldered correctly on the badge. And then we have a hardware hacking village where people bring their badges and we help them fix them, kind of things. But like, that kind of stuff happens. I mean, it's like, goes from like a sketch on a piece of paper and a bunch of drawings with arrows about components and things I want. I slide it across the table to, you know, to some professors at DePaul, and then they go to town on it. And I mean, literally we get those badges, you know, I'll get them to my house 2 days before the conference. And, you know, sort of hoping that they fire up and work. And we've had some mishaps over the years, but
that is some faith-based fabrication.
Yes. Yeah. And that's not, I mean, that's just like, that's a side thing, right? That's like a thing that people get at the conference. It has nothing to do with like,
right. Like, it's just the entry point.
Yeah. It's not like the catering and the AV companies and, you know, like,
and the program of content
and paying taxes on. And, you know, it's an organization, so you got to have your accountants and all that. So it's quite a little bit of an operation, but it's also bursty, right? Like, it happens for a couple of months at the beginning of the year, and then I don't do anything. I don't even think about it really.
So what I have a question for you, Nick. When in the last 11 years, when did it shift from being, you know, a HackerCon that is basically Nick invites a bunch of his friends to like a conference that is a 503c organization and has a staff, and, you know, it's a volunteer staff, but it's still a staff. It's not just the Nick Prococo show, right? And I'm kind of curious, like, when that transition happened for ThoughtCon.
Yeah, it was never just me. I would say even from the beginning, we always had volunteers. And we have some lead oppers. So it's basically me, folks that you may be familiar with in the security industry, like Jakku and Video Man and Saki Bomb and Makuta. So like we have a core group. It's like the board, basically. That actually came a little bit later into a formal board. But Mm-hmm. Essentially, I would say around ThoughtCon 3 or 4 is when it actually got, it was not as, it was actually at LLC, like non-for-profit for a little while. Always chartered that there was nobody on payroll, right? It was always the money was just going to go roll back right back into the business. But then we started growing. We started growing to a place where the accountants for ThoughtCon were like, your revenue, like ticket revenue, is growing to a place that's over a certain amount. And now you're going to have to start paying like some serious taxes on this stuff. And we're like, well, that doesn't really make sense because we're not for profit. And there was some recommendation there that we'd be better if we spun it to a 501c3, because then we can get charitable contributions. We always had people that would make like pseudo donations to us, like here and there. They'd be like, hey, this is awesome. I want to send you guys an extra $100 or something. But no one could they can't tax right off giving, you know, me and a couple of guys $100, right?
Right.
So we spun it to a 501c3. I sort of lose track of like time, but I think it was like ThoughtCon 8, I think, or 9 is when we spun it. We basically shut down what was called ThoughtCon NFP and started an organization called ThoughtCon Infinity NFP, started to open it up so we can get donations. And we started, and we get, you know, a handful of donations every year from folks and also some organizations. And then started being able to offer like VIP tickets that would have a tax deductible portion of it. Started being able to offer some sponsorships for the party and for the students. So for students to get discounted tickets and be able to have people get tax deductions for that. And that's where things sort of accelerated a bit from an interest perspective, with either individuals or other people. And that's when we sort of spun a little bit into trying to be more outwardly focused into the community outside of just ThoughtCon itself, right? It was all 100% focused on ThoughtCon and bringing speakers in and giving people opportunities to speak, whether, first-time speakers and all of that. But then it started getting a little bit more of like, let's look outside of the ThoughtCon bubble and see what we can do. And that happened a couple of years ago.
That's awesome. I like the ThoughtCon Infinity. It's very Avengers inspired. I liked it. So tell us about the nonprofit a little bit more.
Yeah. So basically, ThoughtCon, the conference, is produced by an organization called ThoughtCon Infinity. That is a 501c3 tax exempt, federally recognized tax exempt organization, and just like any other charity. People can make donations that are tax deductible for that. But beyond that, the charter changed a little bit. Not only do we produce ThoughtCon, right, as a conference, but we also want to do more community-based giving back, activities. And so we did one a couple of years ago where I had an idea and I approached the president of the Chicago Public Libraries in Chicago and said, what if we had during Cybersecurity Awareness Month, what if we had a cybersecurity essentially action day where at all the Chicago public libraries across the whole city in every neighborhood in every part of the, and there was like 79 of them or 78 of them, we staffed it up with people from ThoughtCon that would set up a table and basically give free security support, basically. Like, how do I lock down? How do I, for basically passwords, patching, and privacy was sort of like the three P's of focus. And we advertised it and got a bunch of people, and it was a great rewarding experience. We did that once. We tried to do it this year, but unfortunately, the Chicago Public Library wanted to greatly reduce the footprint down to just the locations where they thought they would get the most foot traffic. Mm-hmm. And in talking to the volunteers, some of the most rewarding experiences people had were where they sat there for 4 hours and only three people came by. Because the people, and you can imagine they have some, there's some Chicago Public Library branches that are in underprivileged areas of the city. And so they said they had people come in that had their only computer for their entire family and wanted help, patching it and helping them and their kids, with their privacy settings so they could be more secure, right? And they could, to get 2FA enabled on their accounts and all those kind of things. And they were like, yeah, it was just one person and his two kids, but it was like incredible experience versus, having it be the one that's in like, the Gold Coast where you get tons of foot traffic. 40 people came by, but they asked like one question and they walked away. right? And so that was a real bummer for us. We're like, well, those, even though we had the most foot traffic during the first year, like the people said the foot traffic there was, you know, almost meaningless compared to the high white glove touch experiences they were having with the underprivileged areas.
Yeah, it didn't feel as impactful, even though you're talking to more people.
Right. Yeah, and it wasn't what we wanted, right? So then we said, okay, well, we're not going to do it this year. We're going to think of something else. And at the same time, we were spinning up an effort to do a scholarship fund. That was something I wanted to do for a while, but it takes money, right, to do that, because that's what it is. And so I then, you know, had to figure out, like, well, can we just give a scholarship to somebody? Can we just, like, write a check to somebody? And found out that that's not such a great idea. And working through, like, a scholarship management organization is a better idea legally, and also from a selection standpoint. And so we ended up having, then we had to shop around and find, you know, who was the best one for that for us. And we found one, and then it took a little while, but we kicked that off. And I actually just got an email 10 minutes before we jumped on, you know, to record this, that, that we have selected the student, for that. I don't know who that is yet, because that's part of the whole model, is I'm not able to, like, select. Right. It sort of has to be unbiased, and it's by a sort of a panel kind of thing. So so I don't know who that is yet, but the criteria for the scholarship, it's a $5,000 scholarship the first year. That's what we're trying to do this year, or we are doing this year. And it's the criteria is someone who goes to a Chicago public school, has an interest in cybersecurity or related sort of place, you know, related things, has demonstrated some interest in it. And has a financial need, as well. And then also, you know, gets decent grades in school, right? So there's a, you know, sort of the default criteria for a scholarship. And that was the goal, and, you know, kicked it off. A bunch of Chicago public schools, high school seniors applied for it. And, you know, a couple of weeks later we selected somebody. And so out of that, obviously, once we find out, we're going to notify them, we're going to invite them to ThoughtCon. You know, probably them and their, you know, probably they probably want to bring a parent or something like that with them.
They probably don't.
They probably don't.
Right. Yeah, you might bring a parent, but they probably don't.
Yeah, probably not. Yeah, we probably will say you have to bring a parent. But then, yeah, hopefully maybe we'll have to figure this out, but, you know, hopefully be able to give them a reward, maybe print out a large, you know, ThoughtCon check that has, like, black background with white lettering or something on it with our V Trooper logo on it or something. And then, you know, and reward, you know, award them, you know, that scholarship on stage.
And so can they use that money for anything, or is it specifically to be used for specific things?
Yeah, it's specifically for higher education. Yeah. Yeah. That's the criteria. It does not go, like, directly to a student. Like, we don't write them a check. And in fact, we actually send the money to Scholarship America. And then when the student is going to, like, a community college or a four-year university or whatever they're going to that sort of fits into that criteria, then Scholarship America basically sends the money to that place in their behalf.
And do they have to be enrolling in a program that relates to cybersecurity?
Yeah, that's the criteria. Yeah, yeah. So it was, you know, your interest in it and also going to explore some sort of cybersecurity. Now, it doesn't have to be you're going to, you know, a four-year university, getting a bachelor's in computer science, and, you know, that would be awesome. But it could be, hey, I don't really know, but I know, but I'm going to go to, you know, one of the city colleges in Chicago and start taking some classes. And there's, oh, by the way, there's a, you know, computer science intro class with some cybersecurity stuff. So it really could be someone going, you know, it could be, right, you know, computer science, right? It doesn't have to be just cybersecurity.
That's super cool, Nick. It's a huge thing. And really great to hear about initiatives like this happening. You know, I just was talking to some people from the Diana Initiative who have created a fund to provide sort of mini scholarships for 10 students to go attend Hacker Summer Camp. And just for people who are interested in that, I think there's some information online. If you look up Diana Initiative, the scholarships are not gender biased or anything like that. Anyone can apply. You just have to be a student who is doing something that I think relates to cybersecurity in some way. It could be policy, could be law, could be computer science. And it is money towards covering expenses to attend the sort of plethora of security conferences that happen within that first week of August in Vegas. And they'll also try and help you get passes to get into things like DEF CON and that kind of stuff. So yeah, we're checking out students who are interested. But yeah, I think it's great that there are more of these things happening, and that more people are investing in the next generation, both on a, you see it on a government level, you see it on a corporate level, companies doing this as part of their corporate social responsibility efforts. And also you're starting to see it on a, like an individual and community level, which I think is really inspiring. So big props to you guys for doing that.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, and we're not stopping there with the scholarship. I mean, this was a trial balloon essentially to see if this actually can work. You know, next year we hope to do 2 or maybe 3 scholarships, award that many. And then, you know, like personal milestone would be really great for us to be giving out like 10 of these a year kind of thing.
I love the fact that you never rest on your laurels, that you always look for how you can push further. I think that's a really awesome thing. Good for you. Really inspiring. It's been so fun hearing about this stuff. If only I'd, you know, been invited to ThoughtCon, I feel like I would have had much. Sorry, I can't help it. It's just so fun. You're used to me trolling you. But no, it's really cool stuff, Nick. And it's so great to hear about what's going on with you and how ThoughtCon has evolved over time. It is a super highly regarded conference, and people speak about it with great affection and respect. And I, you know, I do hope that I will get to come at some point, all joking aside. Todd, do you have anything else that you wanted to throw at Nick other than just your undying love?
Yeah, that's basically it. I mean, ThoughtCon is my, I always tell people ThoughtCon is my favorite regional conference. And I say that as someone who has organized a regional conference for several years.
Still organized a regional conference.
And it's great. You should go. Also, probably tickets are sold out, I assume, by this point for this upcoming May.
That's the difficult part, right? When it becomes popular. So, you know, there's limited size of venues in Chicago and all things related to that. We've been exponentially selling tickets out faster every year. So think last year, so in ThoughtCon A, right, we sold tickets out in 3 days. And the time before that, we sold them out in 3 weeks. And the time before that, we sold it out in like 2 months, I think. This year, we sold out in 13 hours.
Oh boy.
so like next year, is it going to be like 3 hours or 4 hours? And then it'll end up being like the F5 kind of thing,
it'll
right?
It'll be the F5 event, exactly.
Yeah. So, and that's difficult, right? I don't want it to become like this out of control, like, you know, lottery. And that at the same time, we don't really have the capacity to take on
a digital currency company. Why don't you just make like a ThoughtCon coin?
We can.
No?
Yeah, mint, just mine
let
a
the
coin.
Market decide.
Yeah. ThoughtCon will do an ICO and and then we'll raise like a few billion dollars and open up like the ThoughtCon arena in Chicago.
Maybe don't do that.
Like, what number are you sort of tapped at the moment then?
So we're at the capacity we're at now. We'll have about 1,700 people at ThoughtCon this year. The venue that we're at now, which always says it's top secret. So I can't tell you where it's going to be. It's always top secret. We've never put the name of the venue on our website ever. But we can't really go beyond that. And the problem in Chicago is that it's, unfortunately, your choices are like, once you get to that size, your choices are to stick at that size, or you have to step up to like the hotel kind of convention kind of venues. Right. And there's plenty of those, right? Like, we have, you know, massive, massive convention hotels in Chicago, just, you know, similar to like Las Vegas, right, and convention centers. But that's a completely different animal, and I'm not sure I want to approach that, because then you get to the place where, like, you get to a world where like you can't run your own power strips, and each power strip is $250, right? Like, things get wildly out of control, and we wouldn't be able to just charge like, you know, $150 to $200 for a ticket. We have to charge like $1,500 a ticket, and it sort of devolves pretty quickly there.
Yep, that's really hard. So when I said maybe I'll get to go one day, maybe I won't get to go.
Yeah, I've changed my advice. Don't go to ThoughtCon. Just ignore it.
Right. So as Todd was saying, you're sold out for this year. When is the conference this year?
It's in May.
And I'm assuming that means that the CFP has already been and gone.
The CFP, yeah, we do things really early. I guess we sort of take maybe a cue from RSA in that regard. So we sell tickets. These tickets go on sale October 1st every year for the next year. And so used to take us until like February or April to sell out, February or March or something like that to sell out tickets. And now, unfortunately, we sell it out like a couple hours after they go on sale. And then the CFP opens October 1st as well, and it closes January 1st. And we just notified all of the speakers last week, I think, is when we notified them. And so now, you know, we have a really awesome lineup of folks that we'll be announcing soon.
So basically, if you want to go to ThoughtCon, speak at ThoughtCon.
Yes.
That seems to be the easiest way to get a ticket.
Next year, not this year. Yes.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on. It was really lovely to catch up with you and to admire your beard. I look forward to seeing you in Vegas, if not sooner.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, thank you guys. We'll talk soon.
So Todd, what have you got for us in the rundown today? Is it all the excitement that came out of RSA?
It is not. as you might know, I don't typically go to talks at RSA. I'm usually busy with like booth stuff. And of course, we recorded a pile of podcasts, really, actually, at RSA, which was pretty fun.
And people can look forward to the corridor noises coming to them soon.
Yes, it's awesome. It was actually a pretty good setup, despite being in hallways around Moscone Center. But it was great. It was a bunch of like face-to-face podcasting that we did. But
I know, and I don't you wish we could do that all the time?
Well, I don't know. As long as we keep our social distancing and are constantly washing our hands during, then yes.
Okay, so less time with me, but more face-to-face podcasting. Got mm-hmm. it.
Yep.
Okay, and also for those who missed it, Todd is our most glamorous booth babe. You uh-huh. should definitely check out Rapid
I don't know about that.
Events for Todd.
They're pretty fun. I make it very clear that I'm no longer technically in marketing, and I'm also not sales, so I'm super bad at selling our products, but good at talking about research. So
Great.
people seem to like that.
It's almost like that's your job.
Mm-hmm. and speaking of research, the thing I do want to talk about is the Emotet malware delivery system. It's pretty neat, and it's there's a new capability that got announced somewhat recently. It was February, and it's pretty cool. If you want to talk about that, I'm happy to give you the quick 411 on that.
I mean, let's talk about it. It sounds all like right. It's the most goth of all the mummies. Emoji.
It is. A lot. It's a shoegazing mummy. It's not technically goth.
I know. I couldn't come up with another like equivalent without saying emo. So yeah.
Binary Defense is a company, and they do malware research. I don't personally do a bunch of malware research, so this was all kind of news to me. And it was pretty fun to learn about it. But here the big news is that Emotet, which is a downloader, and we'll get into that, it typically spreads through like malicious docs and email. So it's like it'll come in on an email and it'll say like, hey, click here for your latest invoice. It often like masquerades as financial email. And then you click here and then you get a Word doc and it prompts you 15 times to like, do you really want to run these macros? And you say, yes, 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 yes. And then you get compromised. And then it spreads around. And typically the way it spreads is that it'll rummage through your local Outlook contacts and then start emailing everyone you know as you. But now it has this new capability, which is fascinating, wherein it takes a hold of your wireless network and then scans around for all the wireless networks that you can see like right now. So if you're like in a busy office building or in a work share space, or even if you're at home and your neighbors have really loud Wi-Fi networks, it will notice those and then try to log into those. And then once it logs into those, it does like a bunch of kind of traditional, you know, just spamming around that new network that you're now on, looking for other victims. And so this is interesting because while it used to spread like on, you know, the local network, which malware does, or spread via spam, which malware does, this is, as far as I know, the first one that actually takes takes control of your Wi-Fi network, necessarily kicking you off of your network, getting you onto other networks, and then trying to spread that way. So if your neighbor gets owned by Emotet, you might get owned by Emotet if your Wi-Fi password is super weak. Now, I don't know what weak passwords means. It's probably, you know, something like password or guest or things like that. You know, the kinds of things that like guest networks tend to have, because a lot of companies, they will run, you know, their Wi-Fi, the real Wi-Fi, corporate Wi-Fi, and then the guest network for people who show up and you know, just need to log in. And those guest passwords tend to be pretty easy and pretty common. I'm trying to get a hold of what the actual password list is. You know, this is my complaint at Binary Defense. When they published this research, they failed to mention like what the list of passwords is. So we will know like, well, what are the passwords that we shouldn't be picking specifically? Because it doesn't do like brute forcing, and it's not smart. You know, it's just kind of a dumb malware thing. It just goes off of this list. And so having that list would be super helpful. But the other thing that I find interesting about this is that it kind of opens the door to a bunch of other stuff, right? Like if Emotet is able to do this, you know, I foresee a time where it will start using exploits against Wi-Fi, right? Because Emotet targets consumers, you know, end users, people at home, corporate networks, government networks, like all kinds of stuff. And so I can see this like trying to use like old, you know, Linksys and D-Link bugs to try to just like pop other networks and then get on that way. So that's something that I'm cautiously predicting will be in the future of malware, specifically Emotet, and then probably others. If this turns out to be useful, I see no reason why malware authors wouldn't try to use this capability somewhere else. As we use more and more Wi-Fi, I would expect to see that this would be a pretty sound tactic for malware.
Hey Todd, so we lost Jen.
Oh,
so
we no.
We just let you go and it was perfect. But I'm going to stop the recording and then we're going to try to reload her. Continue the convo.
All right.
So yeah, so I dropped and missed your entire magnificent rant about Emotet. But uh-huh. I'm really looking forward to listening to the podcast now. So all about it and being edumacated.
I was wondering why I was allowed to go on.
Right, you were like, she's not interrupting me for once. I am going to make the most of this opportunity. Yeah.
So anyway, TLDR, Emotet, Wi-Fi, make sure your Wi-Fi passwords are like reasonable and not things like guest or Linksys.
Cool. Oh, actually, this makes me think of something. So the UK government, just, and as we know, I have a bit of an affinity for the UK government.
Oh, don't we all?
Well, not so much in Europe right now.
Oh, wow.
But the UK government issued guidance last week about cameras. Not anything that we didn't already know. We have put out research extensively in the past about the risks of cameras, and we have seen them being used in botnets like the Mirai attack. But I think they're also being used by people to spy. And there was this great BBC article. We'll include a link in it in the podcast write-up, but this great BBC article that included a video of this incredibly normal British couple who, despite being incredibly normal, had 7 security cameras around their house. So maybe not that normal, but relatively, you know, just standard couple. Like, they're not famous. There's no reason to think that people would want to spy on them. And they had some, the BBC had some security research to take a look at the cameras and discovered that they had been viewed by, I think it was something like 5,000 people around the world, in like 45 different countries or something.
Wow.
And one person in France had just watched for 9 hours.
Okay.
It's super creepy. Like, it was like a total of 320 hours of viewing time that people had just been like watching them on their cameras.
It's a genre, like not, and like not even like the creepy genre of like I'm watching people who don't know I'm watching, but even just like go to Twitch and like sort by least popular and then just watch people just live their lives. It's so weird.
It is super weird, but like I think the point is that like people that you think would never really be an interesting target are being spied on. And so I would say, not to be sort of alarmist about this, but if you have kids, then definitely think about whether or not you've got cameras around your house. And if you have, please make sure that you are changing passwords, that you're not making them remotely accessible unless they really need to be. You know, actually, do you really need the cameras? Like, just think about it in terms of like, you know, weighing the good against the potential risks, because there are nasty people out there who are using this technology not for the purpose it was intended, quite the reverse. And so it's pretty nasty.
Yeah, as far as I can tell, there is no such thing as a like secure by default IP camera. So you always need to like monkey around with the settings. It may be as simple as changing a password. You know, sometimes there's some hoops to jump through for updating firmware and all that, but password change, like if you don't remember changing a password, you haven't changed a password, or
right,
you know,
right.
Like, so that's the trick.
And so I have a question about this. So if you have a sort of Internet of Things camera, right, and it comes with, you know, a shiny app for your mobile so that you can check on it, and like, I don't know, maybe you've got one of those ones that's like motion activated and it sends you alerts to your phone, sure, or whatever it is.
You want to watch your dog when you're not home or something. Yeah.
Right. Like that is a great use case. Yes, lots of people have the doggy cam, or a kitty cam, right? Like an equivalent for, or a nanny cam, or whatever it is. So, if you change the password on your app, is there also a password that you need to change on the device itself, like for the camera?
Oh boy, that's a good question. Typically, no. Typically, what the camera does. Like in that case, usually it's the camera is sending data to like the cloud hosted app. You get that via the cloud hosted app. So that password, your login password, controls the log. I'm trying to think through it, right? Like, is there a good way to even find out? It comes out of the documentation, right? Because the camera has to authenticate somehow too. And a lot of times that is like that machine to machine communication. You know, kind of escapes the notice of developers. This is like, well, I mean, only machines are doing this, so why do we even need a password? And it's like, well, you kind of need one. You know, we found that in the recent Bloomsky disclosure we did, what was that, like 2 or 3 weeks ago, with Andrew. And yeah, like anyone could like log in and start uploading things. They couldn't see the camera, but they could like fake in, you know, their own image streams. On that thing.
Did we name him as the discoverer in the research?
We absolutely did.
Then in which case, since I know he actually does listen to this, we'll just say that was Andrew McPherson. Hi, Andrew.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly the problem, right? Is that people change the password on their app thinking that they've now done what they need to do from a security point of view. And meanwhile, the developers actually kind of made it impossible to secure by not...
It may be impossible. It may be like a pre-shared key or something like that that they use to log in. You know, and so the security is only as good as like as far as no one else like extracts that key from the firmware. There's a lot of ways to do it, but the first and foremost, like I would say that if you have not, again, if you haven't remembered changing your password, you probably haven't. If you change the password on the mobile app, that may be good enough, but it may not. Like, and I don't want like consumers to think like they have to be security engineers and like reverse engineers and IoT hackers in order to just use these devices. That's kind of ridiculous. I would say look at it. And if you have any questions, hey, ask your manufacturer. You know, they might have a privacy policy, so find that out. If they don't have a privacy policy, you can't get a hold of them, that's a super big red flag that you might not want to be using this device anymore.
Yeah, and I think that's an important call out, is that as consumers, as buyers, you guys have power. Like, not perhaps you don't think so on an individual level, but it's like voting, right? You know, you need people to basically exercise that individual power, and then cumulatively it creates an effect, and it starts to apply pressure on vendors. And so, you know, let them hear from you and know that this is something that you think is important and that you care about. Otherwise, they'll continue to deprioritize it, and you are the ones who pay the price for that.
Well, and sucking up minutes on support calls is an excellent way to get their attention, because that is something no one wants to do.
And if you have, like me, if you have questions that you want to ask Todd, then you can email info@rapid7 and just put Security Nation in the subject line, send us your questions,
yep.
Or you can tweet them at rapid7.
Yep.
And we will be happy to address them in future Rapid Rundowns. When I say we, I really mean Todd, since he's the one that knows things.
Well.
All right. So Todd, thank you so much for extensively educating me on Emotet.
Emotet. You will learn that in the future. And then IP cameras, you'll learn that right now.
I wanna just thank our guest again, Nick Pococo. Thank you so much for coming on, Nick. It was great getting a chance to catch up with you. Todd, thank you as usual for being awesome and educating me and putting up with me. And as ever, thank you to our amazing producer Bree, who actually got to participate today.
Yeah.
So yay! Thanks, Bree.